Now, another question that people would be asking now, given the fact that we have something like the creative source, the void, the Satchidananda, we have the certain transcendental need to create of the creative principle, we have something about the mechanics that involves the divisions and the partitioning, and the whole thing is somehow serving the purpose of this fantastic adventure in consciousness, this adventure, this experiment, this divine play, Leela, as the Hindus call it, which accounts for fantastic adventurous possibilities on different levels. Then the question is, how does it happen that I buy a certain self-image that is false? How is it possible that if I am an unlimited spiritual being, I am sort of tricked into understanding or to believing that I am a Newtonian object, that I am a solid body, that I need to eat, that I need oxygen? Now, the best answer that I have heard so far, and it also was confirmed by some of my own experiences, is the following. The whole universe is like this fantastic adventure in consciousness, this incredible cosmic dance. It's a play, it's a piece of art, among others. If you look again at the parallel on the human level with art, a good art will almost replace reality. If you see a good theater play and good performance of actors, or a good movie, you might forget you're in the movies and you really get yourself into it. And if it's a good love story, you know, you might experience sexual arousal. And if it's Exorcist, some people will throw up and they can't stand it and they get out of there as if something was really happening there. So if something is really done with powerful means, it can substitute reality. It can sort of pass for reality. So there is a certain degree of perfection that would be mimicking reality. Now, the source that we are talking about has intelligence and creativity and capacity which is unimaginable on the level to which we are reduced. I mean, this would be like Chopin playing the piano and then reducing himself to a cockroach and then let himself be admired sort of by or a gopher watching mathematicians solving differential equations. I mean, it's that kind of relationship between the intelligence that is available in everyday life and the intelligence that created this. So it has incredible capacity to create an art form where everything is accounted for. All the loopholes are covered in such a way that the principle traps itself with its own perfection. I mean, it creates a show which is so believable that it traps itself. I will give you an example of Baltimore, because one of the persons who experienced this gave that example. Now, if you add to this something like square miles of ugly houses, red and black, uninteresting in Baltimore, people living their sort of trivial lives, you know, snoring and farting and sweating and so on. It takes some analysis, and you have to go to some other levels to realize that this comes from a perfect source. So unless you realize that that was the very purpose, was to create a believable system that would pass for trivial, ordinary, mundane, material reality. Aurobindo has this his extreme statement about the atheist. The atheist is God playing hide and seek with himself. So the atheist would be like the extreme trick of the creative principle. It created something that tries to believably deny itself and so on. But there are some more subtle tricks, like those, you know, the suburbs in Baltimore. So you can substitute anything you want to for that, but I'm sure you find lots of examples. Now, in non-ordinary states of consciousness, you can see through that. You can see the absolute perfection in the trivial, in the mundane. And you can see that it's a necessary part of the creation. So there's absolutely no hierarchy of values, aesthetic or any others. If you take something like kitsch, you, from your human level, you might be very snobbish about it. I mean, it's a really low-level kind of stuff. As long as that person who did it was trying to be like Michelangelo. As long as this was created from a place where it was meant to be kitsch, it's exactly the kinds of emotional reactions that it's going to do. It's a piece of perfection. Do you know what I'm saying? A toad is a toad, and it fits exactly the place it's supposed to fit. It creates an aesthetic impact on us, which is what was meant to mean. So again, back to the movies. You know, there are movies where people want to create an atmosphere of horror or extreme ugliness. It's experimenting with states of consciousness and so on. So from that point of view, there are absolutely no hierarchies. Chimpanzee is just as good as Einstein. I mean, chimpanzee is God, which is sort of perfectly incarnate in a chimpanzee. It was meant to be a chimpanzee. Einstein is the same principle that created what was supposed to be Einstein. So once you have this kind of meta framework, Einstein is no better than a chimpanzee. The chimpanzee is perfect for what it was supposed to be as much as a scientist is. I even have a very strong feeling that this applies, for example, to animals, that the whole idea that their limitations come from their brain capacities, whether they have ganglia or whether they have a brain or how big a brain it is, I really don't believe that this is a relevant way of thinking about it. I believe that each form has a piece of the absolute cosmic intelligence that it's supposed to have for that particular form. So you have these miraculous things where of navigation of birds and so on, and we're trying to put it into their brains and explain it in some kind of natural ways, and you know, we don't have a lot of success. One situation that hit me in a very, very hard way was we had a house in Big Sur, and we had a roof that was overlapping, we had a deck with a railing, and we had a hibachi grill standing there. And one morning I came out to look at the ocean, and there was this most beautiful large spider web, and it was anchored, parts of it were anchored on the railing, parts of it on the hibachi, parts of it were coming from the overlapping roof. Now this kind of thing cannot be done with a few ganglia. I mean, that creature had to have a three-dimensional idea, had limitations. I mean, it couldn't fly, it had to travel in its own way. But you see, to get from this place to that one, it had to go down from the hibachi, go crawl up, go this way, that way, fix it in the right place, and had to have a sense of a geometric of the mandala that it was creating. It was creating it from the limitations of the spider. But the idea that you could explain that from the nervous system which was there, it's just not a very believable theory anymore. So there's a possibility that each creation, each creature, is sharing just the right piece, just the right form of absolute cosmic intelligence. It is good for what it is. So we have now this system where we have the creative source, we have these different levels inhabited by entities that are actually split units of consciousness that have forgotten where they came from. They forgot that they are part with everything else. They experience themselves as separate. And this provides the possibility of this fantastic cosmic dance on different levels, the dramas. And there's a tendency in this system to experiment with whatever can be experimented with. Again, we have our own human ideas about it, what is appropriate, what should be there, what shouldn't be there. You know, the kinds of things we did around sexuality, whether you can be homosexual or you should be heterosexual, you should have one wife or you could have 15 wives, and you know, what degree of intimacy can you have with your brother and sister. Well, that's true for a certain culture. That's not true for the creative principle that is interested. What kind of experience it is if two persons of the same sex interest, how does it differ from when it is people from the same sex? What does it feel like when you put this end to that end? And what does it, what does it feel like? What experiential possibilities there are if you turn it around? If you take a culture like New Caledonia, they kill fraternal twins if they were male and female because they committed incest in the womb. You go to Peru or you go to Egypt, and within the Pharaoh family or the Inca family, the brother has to marry the sister, otherwise it's a scandal. You know, you have cultures where monogamy is such that something else will be punished by death. You have cultures where this polygamy, you have cultures where there is polyandry, you have cultures where they feel perfectly comfortable being nude. You have others where you show your nose and you get killed for that because you should have your face covered. I mean, these are all trips. I mean, we are programmed into taking this, absolutely, we are ethnocentric. Each culture has an idea what is acceptable, what is right, what isn't right. But once in non-ordinary states, you get an overview, and those are all plays. I mean, it's like watching different movies. You know, it's appropriate if you live in a certain culture to play it by the rules. But you can also have another dimension where you have a degree of freedom, where you just see all those are relative things. You don't get caught into those games where people get excited and fighting about these issues and so on. Now, the other thing that people discover within this system, this is just one half of it, going from one to many, from the void or from Satchitananda to a level like this, when you have a lot of separate entities, some are male, some are female, some are black, some are yellow, some are white. You know, some live in one century, others live in another century, some of them are human, some of them are animals, and so on. And then all these sort of interactions. And then the idea is that within the same system, there are also built-in mechanisms through which you can escape the sense of separation and being sort of committed to a particular partial form, and you get a way out into, in non-ordinary states of consciousness, you can sort of dissolve these boundaries and you can start the journey back when you somehow rediscover your own true identity, which you lost contact with. So those are ways to reunion. So they're like two movements, dynamics, the coexisting in the system that we are. One goes from the source to separation, to divisions. The other one is from separation back to unity. Now comes catch 22. In many of the religious systems, you will find out that they would consider this level to be kind of the low level. This is the garbage level. This is the quagmire of death, rebirth. This is the valley of tears. And you want out. I mean, the last thing you want to do is to stay here. So you want out of the cycle of death, rebirth. You want to nirvana. So this is the original, for example, Hinayana Buddhism, where the idea was you want to extinguish the torch of life, you want to get beyond the thirst of flesh and blood, you want to be in nirvana. And nirvana means literally evanescence, you want to fade out of existence, it's too much trouble, it's all associated with suffering. The Jainist religion has the same kind of thing. You are jiva, you're sort of crystalline, pure entity, monad of life, and you are entangled, contaminated by your association with the biological way of existence. You want to purify that and you want to move into this sort of pristine state beyond incarnation, beyond existence. Now, people who had that experience of union with God back to the source realize that there is a problem because that's where creation came from in the first place. So if that state were so satisfying, so self-fulfilling, none of these other things would be here. The principle would simply stay where it is, wouldn't bother to do these other things. So that there's a discovery that there is no way that principle can not to create. It is a fundamental, transcendental need of that state to create out of itself. So now what is the solution? The solution here, according to the insights that people get when they get to those levels, is that the level of the phenomenal world and the transcendental level of the Satchitananda, those are two complementary realities. They somehow need each other. You find in some of the spiritual literature is that people need God, but God also needs people. Or in some of the aboriginal religions, you see God's created humanity for a particular purpose. So there's a kind of symbiosis, there is an interaction, dynamics, there's a dialectic dialogue sort of happening. The solution then would be to be here, fully here, sort of incarnate, to be in the world, to be in the phenomenal world, This is the solution which was also found in the Mahayana Buddhism, where the nirvana is not evanescence, it's not going out of here, but it's to eliminate certain forces within this incarnation that makes existence tolerable or even exciting. And the three forces are represented by a pig, by a rooster, and by a snake. Those forces are anger, aggression, desire, lust, and ignorance. So if you can eliminate some, if you can inner transformation overcome or diminish those three forces within yourself, then you can be in the phenomenal world incarnate, and at the same time you don't experience profound suffering. Or if you go through something unpleasant, you have this metta framework to which you can sort of relate it. So the idea is that this level has something to offer, a certain experiential possibilities that the undifferentiated cosmic state does not have. It has it in a potential form, but not concretized. Only on this level can you have a child. Only on this level can you listen to Beethoven, or go windsurfing, or go hiking, or eat bouillabaisse, or whatever your thing is, whatever you enjoy. So this level has something to offer, but to be totally identified just with this, in other words, to lose the awareness that it's a play and take it, to buy it, sort of be a real sucker for the, you know, to believe that this is all there is, means to getting lost in the play, to be like in the movies and believing that what's happening is there, rather than believing that it's this play of vibrations, of shadows and lights and so on. So the idea would be to be here, experience whatever is part of the experience, but have also this other level, this sort of meta level, the sense of one's true identity. It would be like Olivier, you know, playing Othello or whatever it is, Hamlet, and being fully involved in it and really be part of the play, but somewhere in the back of the head, there is also the knowledge that you are not really a murderer, that you are Laurence Olivier and so on. Sometimes people give also this parallel with, you know, how do we understand our role? It's the question of free will and determinism. When you go to, or used to go to S-training, I don't know where Werner is now, the final message was, you're God, you created your own universe. And there was a peculiar kind of confusion. It was like me, Stan, you see. As you see here, I created the universe. Now, I know that's not true. What seems to be true, at least in non-ordinary states, is all of us created what is here, but not from where we sit now, but from the top of the pyramid. In other words, the fact is that what we are playing now is certain roles in a screenplay which was written by all of us when we were still one entity. So the idea would be like Shakespeare has a concept of a play, let's say Hamlet. At the beginning, all the characters are just thought forms within one mind. And to make it a really good show, you need separate entities. I mean, if they're not real separate individuals, nobody gets killed, you know, nobody can love and hate anybody else, so you wouldn't have a real story. So for that purpose, you need separate entities, you need real characters. And what can happen is that theoretically, Shakespeare could write the play and cast himself as Hamlet. Now, from the level from which he was writing the play, he had a different degree of free will than from the level from when you are cast into a role, because there it's pretty much determined. And the problem here, the free will and determination and so on, comes from what Gregory Bateson would call an error in typing. That means the Shakespeare who wrote the play is not the same Shakespeare who is in the cast. You know, there's no absolute conflict between free will and determinism. Depends on with which level we identify. Are we really aware of our true identity, or are we identifying with the actor? Are we identifying with the protagonist? Now, how does this relate to what we're doing, the holotropic breathing? How does it relate to what we call psychopathology? Traditionally, what we call psychopathology. Now, up to this point, Western science has been exploring a certain image of human beings as being Newtonian objects, solid entities, skin-encapsulated egos, if you want, complex biological machines, thinking machines, highly developed animals. This is the image that we got in the medical school. And in this context, consciousness is seen as a product of the brain. Some of the extreme forms of materialism, like what is now called vulgar materialism, you can find statements like, there's nothing special about consciousness. Consciousness is just an organic physiological function. The brain produces consciousness like the kidneys produce urine. So this is the extreme of the medical model. I mean, the consciousness somehow comes of the, as an epiphenomenon, it has to do with the complexity of the neurophysiological processes. Now you have people like Penfield, who was one of the founders of neurosurgery, brain research. He died, and just before his death, he wrote a book called The Mystery of Mind. And in a nutshell, his conclusion was, as far as he's concerned, consciousness cannot possibly come out of the brain. I mean, there's some kind of parallelism happening between the neurophysiological processes and consciousness, but the idea that the whole thing is happening inside of your skull just didn't make it for him after decades of really daily, systematic daily research on neurosurgery, neurophysiology, and so on. But this is the image of human beings that we have. Now, what's coming now from modern consciousness research, from psychedelic research, from the breathing and other experiential psychotherapies and so on, from near-death experiences, from thanatology, from some of the more enlightened anthropologists who work with shamans and so on, call themselves visionary anthropologists, who actually participate in rituals rather than sitting on the tree with a writing pad and sort of observing what the natives are doing. We have now powerful confirmation coming from these modern developments in science that confirm now quite systematically another image of human beings that has been around for centuries or millennia as part of the so-called perennial philosophy. And that is the image that our true nature is we are consciousness. And physical reality comes from consciousness.